I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Hello, Martin.
Great to be here, Michael, as always.
Well, it's lively times, lots of rain in Fremantle recently. SpaceX is just about to have its initial public offering. Could be the world's, or will be the world's, first trillionaire who comes out of it, Elon Musk. We can perhaps come back to talk about that. Did you see that the Ukraine Russia war has now gone on longer than the First World War went on for? I mean, I've always growing up thought the First World War went on forever, which I suppose is a fair description of this Ukrainian-Russian war, Martin.
It's a good analogy. I mean, obviously you can't compare scale and suffering, and World War One was the most horrific conflict in history at the time, so you can imagine. The length of time this has gone on, if you asked Vladimir Putin how long this conflict would go on when he invaded Ukraine, I suspect it wouldn't have been 4+ years. So I think it's a real indictment on his inability to win the war in the way that he thought he would. It's probably also a testament to some resilience on the part of the Ukrainians and their support that they've been able to elicit from other places. It's that old adage, Michael, it's a lot easier to get into a war than get out of one. And I think Putin's found this. And I'm not sure he has an easy escape hatch anymore, especially when you see Ukraine attacking parts of Russia, including St. Petersburg now.
It's quite astonishing. I mean, Ukraine was always a big part of the old USSR. They're a powerhouse. A lot of the leaders of the USSR came from that part of the world. They've got a great history, smart people, great agricultural country. You can understand why Putin wants to have them, but you can understand also how they want to be on their own and are capable of continuing the fight. But there's another war going on. It hasn't quite reached those lengths, but it wouldn't surprise me if one day it does, Martin. The headline on the New York Times this morning, Trump having said not so long ago, like he was going to attack Thursday night again, Trump again claims Iran deal is close after attracting threat of strikes. So it's the on-off again. You keep telling me every time we talk about Trump, don't look at what he says, look at what he does. Well, I'm not sure he's doing anything here. I mean, what do you make of all of this?
Well, there's been direct fighting again between Iran and the US. We've seen several days of strikes this week on both sides. It's a reminder of how fragile that ceasefire, if you can really call it a ceasefire, actually is. I think it's better to probably call it downscaling of conflict, maybe for now. I think Trump still wants to strike a deal, but he's trying to project strength at the same time. And so there's a two-paced response here that he's trying to manage. And then he's got Israel. Now, Israel is going and doing off its own thing still, and that's incredibly difficult. We had the curious sight of Donald Trump trying to tell Israel and Iran to both dial down and resist inflaming things. But of course, he's a participant in the event, in the conflict. And he's trying to sort of portray himself as somewhat of a mediator at the same time. Those two roles don't coexist. That speaks to that dilemma that he's got. He needs to get out of it, but then he doesn't want to. He wants to convince the American public in particular that there was a point to all of this. So he's got to extract some concessions, but the longer it goes, the harder it is for him to do that.
Well, the longer it goes, Martin, the more I'm reminded of what happened in 1979, 1980, 1981, after the big revolution and the Shah was expelled, all of that in Iran. American hostages were taken, which upset everybody. Jimmy Carter was the president at the time. He couldn't get them back. And in fact, it wasn't until after he lost the presidential contest to Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan took his oath of office, that the Iranians released all of the hostages. The hostage crisis lasted 444 days, Martin, from the 4th of November 1979 to the 20th January 1981, the day after Reagan took his oath of office. They were just They just played them out, the Iranians did. And I'm starting to think maybe that's what's going to happen here. And maybe the midterms is a good time. Keep the pressure on Trump until after the midterms. Am I crazy?
Well, I thought it's a long way away, November, but that's still possible. If you told us at the start of this conflict that it would go on this long, I thought it'd be resolved earlier. But Iran is definitely playing the long game at the moment, and I think that's really frustrating Trump. He's not in a position to force regime change without massive commitment of human resources as well as other resources. He's not in a position to easily rein in Israel, which is a crucial part of this, and he's not finding it easy to extract some terms on the nuclear side of things either. So unless he's basically going to admit defeat and have a longer deal without achieving anything, he may need to concede further. And if this is still dragging on to the midterms, I think it's really going to hurt him, because he's still got all these global interruptions to supply chains, increased prices, uncertainty, business and finance are unhappy, all of these things. So the pressure will ramp up if this drags on for another couple of months.
Well, mark my words, Martin. Unfortunately, there's another part of the world that things never quite seem to fully settle down, and that's Northern Ireland. We've got things happening in Belfast this week, which are quite awful. I have to do with people on the right wanting to say they want anybody who's black or coloured to leave the country. There's obviously a terrible murder which involved a Sudanese fellow murdering somebody. There was some video going around. It's possibly still accessible, but it's been taken down by the officials. But then, of course, all of the hooded men came out and started hoeing into anyone who was, as I say, black or coloured. What have you made of the Belfast? And is it some sort of unfortunate harbinger? What could even happen here?
And I don't think he actually killed him. I think he's in hospital.
Oh, you're
So,
right. He was fighting for his life. Yes.
Look, it was an awful thing. Obviously, the attack's awful, and to see someone, it appeared to be an attempted beheading in public view, and a lot of it. And these individual instances serve as lightning rods for the far right. They really utilize this and weaponize this as an opportunity to increase their reach and their voice, and. That's certainly been the case in Belfast. It's very disturbing, because a much, much broader community that are peace loving, that are normal, that are abide by the laws like everyone else, are targeted and become victims accordingly. So as horrific as an individual attack is, remember, crime happens all the time. Awful things happen all the time. But these individual instances that involve a migrant, for instance, or sometimes even a supposed migrant, Michael, they don't always check the facts on these things, then get weaponized for political reasons against a much broader group. And I think that in the case of Belfast, this is a country that has a different type of border than the rest of Britain. It's has a border with Ireland, which is in the EU, so it has different immigration considerations. And that again is fuel for the far right to take advantage of.
Yes, and I suppose these sort of events, which have global reach where they're put on television screens and social media, play out in countries like Australia as well. This is why we don't want anybody from any of these countries coming to this country, sort of rhetoric, Martin.
Well, a lot of people have attributed the rise of One Nation to the Bondi attacks, and there's certainly some truth in that, absolutely. And there's some similarities there. Two people who engaged in awful conduct, reprehensible conduct, but that was weaponized against a much, much broader group of people. So you had Pauline Hanson questioning whether there were any good Muslims in Australia. Now we're getting probably close to 1 million Muslims in Australia. Do we have 1 million bad people because two people, and maybe they've got some broader network around them that are also awful, but that's not 1 million people. And so it's a conflation of single acts to a whole group of people that is the disturbing part.
Well, let's stay with One Nation. Pauline Hanson has been in the West. Came arrived on Wednesday, Martin. She sent out a well, somebody did in One Nation a request for people to donate. I got an unsolicited text message. Fremantle Shipping News put an article up about it. A question whether they provided an opt-out clause as they're meant to do. Well, I couldn't find it. But she's here. She's been getting a lot of attention, and it appears right around the country that One Nation's opinion polling is very good on the face of it. They're the leading political party in the country at the moment, Martin.
Yes, so the last couple of opinion polls have had them leading now at around about 30, 31% of the primary, outstripping Labor now, and the Liberals are very distant third. And this is reasonably consistent across the country. There are obviously stronger in Queensland, less strong in places like Tasmania and South Australia. In Western Australia, we have a history over here of voting for One Nation in some numbers. They've been elected to the state parliament a number of different times, and we have a One Nation senator at the moment. So they've got a track record here, Michael, of doing okay. And she's drawing some decent crowds in coming over here and a few protesters as well. So she's certainly a lightning rod for different views in the community.
Well, I would have thought Pauline has to be really pleased when the protesters come out and make noise and hold their placards up. It's a show that she's a force to be reckoned with. Maybe they should stay home if they really want to be effective in their protests, Martin. What do you think about the right to protest?
I don't know it's working. I'm not sure that works, the coming out and protesting her coming, because she loves a fight. And for her, she likes portraying herself as the victim. And I think that it probably helps her cause if you've got people with placards every time she turns up somewhere.
Well, she's certainly portraying herself, if not a victim, as having being the common girl around the place, the common woman. She made some references without wanting to go into it, that she suffered domestic violence in a marriage. That sort of normalizes her as a candidate, given there's so much of that sort of issue. She also has got, clear about the fact that Gina Rinehart is her friend, and she takes policy advice from her. What do you make of that sort of, yep, there I am, take me or leave me? It sounds a bit Trumpian. I've got these warts, but you take me, warts and all.
I saw that analogy too. I mean, Donald Trump successfully portrayed himself as an outsider that was in touch with the common person at the same time as being a multimillionaire, and with many, many millions to his name. And Pauline Hanson is rubbing shoulders with Australia's wealthiest woman, whilst at the same time portraying herself as anti-elite. And anti-woke and all of those slogans as well. And so it's a curious double take. Labor's trying to sort of make something of this and portraying her as a sort of Gina's woman, etc. I'm not sure that it alone will cut it. I think that probably they want to focus a bit more on the lack of policy in One Nation. And I think so. I think Albanese was correct to say that economic issues are a big part of this. So if the government can sell an economic narrative, they'll do a bit better. But they've got a lot of work to do, as Pauline Hanson's popularity here in WA shows.
Well, it's interesting. You made a comment about perhaps the One Nation vote has risen since the Bondi tragedy. Why would that be the case? Is that just a simple immigration issue, is it, Martin, without using the word racist?
So the biggest single policy, if you asked, what's One Nation about? And you could ask this 5, 10, 15 years ago, it would be anti-immigration. That's been a consistent policy setting they've had. And then if you have two people that appear to be from migrant backgrounds that commit this atrocity, that plays into that narrative. One is a migrant, the other one was born here. The migrant came here about 3 decades ago. So the facts don't quite fit the narrative, Michael, but that's not probably that important in today's world. Nevertheless, that narrative's there. And if you also think about cost of living, the lack of housing, all the challenges of delivering services, it's very easy to point towards immigrants as a major factor in that issue. And so immigration, I think, is a very big driving issue. But the fact that people aren't doing so well at the moment and finding things difficult really does contribute to this.
It seems though the traditional major parties, Labor, who's in government, of course, and the Libs, who'd like to be together, perhaps with their National Party colleagues, don't quite know how to respond to the phenomenon that we are seeing before us, One Nation. There was a headline that Angus Taylor said that they wouldn't be seat sharing with One Nation. There was earlier discussion about preference sharing, which seems to have been more or less adopted. But what's vote sharing all about? Sorry, seat sharing all about, Martin?
Yeah, there is a significant distinction, and I think it's fair enough to rule this out. So, preference swapping is where in your how to vote cards, you recommend preferencing each other ahead of other major opponents, such as Labor in particular, right? So, under that scenario, Liberal would preference One Nation ahead of Labor, and Labor and One Nation would preference Liberals ahead of Labor. That makes sense? Seat sharing is where they would agree to carve up seats so that they don't compete against each other in certain seats. That's a much higher level of cooperation. That's what we get with the Liberal and National parties currently. That would be a very big call for Angus Taylor and the Liberals to make. So I'm not surprised they're not keen on that at all.
Well, it doesn't surprise me either. They would effectively be going into coalition with One Nation before the next election if they agreed to do that, Martin.
They would, and I think that would certainly open up accusations that they're effectively already in that coalition, and we should they would start being held responsible for One Nation's policy settings, which I think is something he just doesn't want to have to face.
The narrative recently has been that the concerns presented by One Nation are all for the coalition and not for Labor, and Labor can just carry on as normal. But I'm not quite so sure about that. Labor have to get serious, don't they? There's plenty of reportage that the Prime Minister has recently acknowledged reforms to negative gearing and capital gains tax and so on were in part designed to counter One Nation. And the sort of issues that were seemingly pushing people to embrace this right-wing populism. And now you've got the unions also starting to target her as though she's the opposition leader. You know, people are ignoring Angus Taylor. So Labor and the union movement need to get their thinking caps on as well, Martin, which must just excite Pauline Hanson when she gets up in the morning.
Yes, so make no mistake about it, with their surge in the polls and the higher they get, One Nation is absolutely a threat to the Labor Party in the seats it holds. Once you start polling 30% nationally, you can be comfortably assuming you're getting 40, 50 plus in certain seats, and you can comfortably assume that they're finishing at least second and potentially getting Liberal preferences in a number of seats against Labor. So, I've got no doubt. I mean, they're polling much higher than they did in South Australia, and they pushed Labor in several seats in South Australia earlier this year. So Labor should be worried, and they need to think of a strategy to combat her.
Well, their current strategy is to tell their MPs, apparently, that what One Nation offers is anger and slogans, but not solutions and answers, Martin. I suppose you have to have a catchy phrase to be repeated in the Uber car when you're going to the airport or the taxi if you still catch one.
Well, that's a pretty simple message. I saw those talking points delivered to Labor MPs. They kind of make sense for a Labor campaign. I think that their holding pattern whilst Labor works out its really refines its attack. So, you say that they're a protest party, they're a grievance party, they don't really have any solutions. In the meantime, you've got your boffins behind the scenes in their focus groups working out what to explicitly say. Because I think they're going to need more than that, but it makes sense to plug that line for now.
Well, I mean, thinking as a if we were One Nation strategists, all they want to do is have people having this discussion that you and I are having all the way from now to the next election day, Martin.
Yeah, I think there's time for Labor to really fight back. Labor and Liberal are in a really different space here. We've got to remember, Liberals are in a tighter space because they're getting hemorrhaged the last two elections to Labor on one side and One Nation on the other. So if they cozy up too much to one nation supporters, then they're going to lose any chance in the cities. They're in a really difficult space. Labor can just pivot to really attacking Pauline Hanson and almost try and say the Liberals are irrelevant. I think that might be their strategy. And when Angus Taylor opens up his mouth to say he's a mouthpiece for Pauline Hanson, I think that they've got their own space. I mean, they're the centre left, Michael, and so I think they've just got to find the fundamental reasons for why they're doing what they're doing and sell them much, much more effectively.
Martin, there's the issue of AUKUS, which doesn't go away. I wonder what Pauline Hanson, I mean, Gina Rinehart thinks about AUKUS.
Well, AUKUS is certainly proving more and more the headache for the government. They've gone from getting one newbie and a couple of second-hand digs to getting all second-hand digs now, and the price tag meanwhile doesn't seem to be coming down, and the question marks over delivery seem to get worse and worse. And we get more information you've probably seen out from the UK, who are the third party here. Just in the past week, senior members of the Starmer administration deeply sceptical about AUKUS's ability to deliver. So that's an issue not going away. It's certainly there. And the government, its problem is it's kind of committed head over heels to this because it's one big military strategy for purchase of new subs going forward. So it's trying to extricate itself from that is really difficult. And of course, the Trump administration, they're not the most amenable to negotiation, Michael. Not the easiest mob to reason with. So I think that they're finding their lines and their public comments about this more and more tricky.
Well, you don't need a whole sort of bag full of crystals to gaze at to think that to know that AUKUS is in trouble. Gareth Evans came out and spoke against it again during the week, Martin.
Yeah, this is another fairly formerly very senior diplomat. You're talking about someone that was Australia's foreign minister for quite a few years in the Hawke government. So, quite a senior person. Has got a lot of work in the region, Southeast Asia region in particular, since that time. Not known to sort of prone to extremes, Michael. No one would say that about Gareth Evans. And he was very critical as well. So, and there are questions being raised by the Liberals in estimates about the AUKUS. So James Patterson, notwithstanding that they're big supporters of AUKUS, they've been asking questions about money and delivery, which I think is quite clever, just to increase the pressure.
Well, one thing they probably don't need to do when they're trying to work out these AUKUS answers, Martin, is have too many bottles of scotch or beer or cocktail mixers on their table. Did you notice a local story during the week, which I quite liked, that more than 800 locals signed a petition to cut off the City of Joondalup councillors' alcohol? They're just going to have water. There ought to
Well,
be, there should be a general rule about this, shouldn't there, in public life?
yeah, no, it's a good point, Michael. Councillors have busy jobs, I'll admit that, and probably all their hours they do not always accounted for, but they do get a stipend that's much more generous than they used to get, and I think that. I mean, they're already getting a range of other costs, such as dinner costs and everything, picked up. But alcohol should be separate from that, in my view. I think they should be picking up their own costs around alcohol. And I think that's where all the good burgers of Joondalup are going when a whole heap of them have signed. I think more than 800 people have signed a petition that to say that they should be purchasing their own booze. So if they're getting a free feed now and again, that's understandable for an evening meeting, but they might wish to at least pay for their own drinks.
Well, we'll watch that space. It'll probably filter through, as I suggest, to every part of public life. I suppose universities have rules along these lines, Martin.
Oh, that certainly. So, what you'll find is that you can pick up costs where there's explicit work-related expenses, and that's quite different. You can't use the university credit card to just go and pay for your own, incidental expenses on a weekend or whatever else. So, we're no different. I would imagine most organisations have a delineation between what are work expenses and what are personal.
Martin, you can't go anywhere where Elon Musk hasn't just been or is about to come, or in fact is already there. His big company, which has been spending years getting ready for this occasion, SpaceX, is set to set a milestone with the world's largest IPO, that is the initial public offering of its shares, which the New York Times says will further his power. The company said it will sell more than 555 million shares at $1.35 US each in its blockbuster initial IPO, which is set to begin trading today. That is tomorrow in the US. And it's going to be enormous. It puts a valuation, if they get that sort of money, at $1.77 trillion, the biggest ever. What do you make of that? Is it just sort of stock market hype? Is it because we're all talking about AI? Is it because Elon Musk's involved and we assume it's going to be a great success? And does it give him that sort of power? I suppose he's already got a lot of power.
Oh, he's got a lot of power. I don't think he needs the money, but I think that he sees money as really central to, as a litmus test for success and influence and all those other things. And there's no doubt that in business that Elon Musk has been extraordinarily successful. And part of the success of business is to be able to sell yourself. And if you can sell this company is worth more than $1 trillion. It's just mind-boggling for one company to be on a public listing like that. Then, that's an extraordinary effort. Of course, a lot of these companies, take quite a considerable period of time to really pay themselves for themselves. But investors will make their own call themselves.
They will do, and people who buy them will be interested to see just how quickly those shares that they buy at that price go up or down, Martin. But we can talk about that next week when we'll have a whole week of trading behind us. But in the meantime, thank you for joining me today on View from the Roundhouse. It's been an interesting set of questions, none of which seem to go away from week to week, month to month, or even year to year these days, Martin.
Well, there's always a few that jump on the agenda and a few others that jump off. Every week's a different week, even if you're sometimes discussing the same matters.
See you next Friday, Martin.
Pleasure as always.